5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We're in the 21st century. Humans that aren't awake survive in a self-made penitentiary. If you're seeking truth, honesty, integrity, stay away from the polarity. There's only one place to turn to. You can't trust the singularity. I'll be that babe spreading higher consciousness, wisdom, because we ain't no one's test subject and we ain't no damn victim. Wake up, humanity, before it's too late. If you sit where I'm sitting, we got a checkmate. Question everything, fairy rings, aliens, reptilians, Arcturians, Palladians, dragons, and even our own origins. Psychic babes, we empower humankind. Seek the truth, but don't seek through the mind. This is how we win, go within, stand together. Colors can't divide us, watch our differences unite us.
Hi guys, welcome to Psychic Babes. I'm your host, Kirsten Standifer. Today we have Stephen Wong. He's the founder of Millennial RH Design, a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultancy that seeks to leverage the power of psychedelics to inspire a generation of leaders to interrogate systems of oppression, learn inclusive management practices, and wield privilege to create positive change. Stephen has worked for over a decade within the tech industry as the first HR analyst at Facebook and Square, and then as the head of diversity and inclusion at Culture App. AMP, he also became a DI consultant for Numinous and for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, otherwise known as MAPS. And he was really dissatisfied with the status quo. So he is focusing on the intersection of DEI and psychedelics to create a shared human consciousness. I love that. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me, Kirsten. It's good to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's just jump right in. I'm a big advocate of psychedelics and entheogens, as most of my audience knows. Mm-hmm. I came from corporate America. Oh, gosh, this was a long time ago. I'm going to date myself here, but over 10 years ago. And DEI was a huge problem when I was in that arena, especially for women. And so I really love how you combine these areas. How did that come to you? Because, I mean, this reminds me of something that would come to me on a psilocybin trip or something.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I worked in HR at first, mm-hmm. and I was in charge of all of HR data. So like, here's all the HR data, here's the hiring data, the recruiting data, the pay, the promotion, the retention, et cetera. And all the problems I wanted to solve were related to identity and diversity. Mm-hmm. Like those are problems that I that saw that just bubbled up for me. It's like, oh, why would women getting promoted be promoted at lower rates? Or why are people of color leaving at higher rates? Like, I'm a data person. So yeah, when I saw the data show where the problems and imbalances and inequities are, those are the problems I immediately wanted to solve.
And how did you bridge that with psychedelics? When was your first experience with psychedelics?
Pretty early. I was, I'm going to say 19 or 20, and it was LSD. And that experience definitely helped me understand like that there are multiple realities that exist. And it helped me kind of like tap into parts of my brain and connect different things that I wanted to do. So back at that time, I was working as a life insurance actuary, calculating when people die, which was mm-hmm. more of a job. And I wanted to move into something where people were alive. And I think like I credit LSD with helping me like transition into HR. It's like, well, I can calculate when people die. I can probably calculate when people are ready to leave a company or when they're ready for a promotion or when they might need a new manager. So that's kind of what I pitched to Silicon Valley. And that's how I got my first job doing HR work.
So LSD kind of, you'd say it kind of opened your mind to the oneness of everything and kind of made you, like you saw these patterns before, but it really made you want to fix them personally.
There have been several moments on LSD throughout my life / professional career that sometimes it's like the period of time where I was using LSD and sometimes it's like specific moments. Okay. Like one time I was at a music festival, this is maybe 2015, and I was in HR then. And I remember experiencing like this deep sense of belonging in the crowd on LSD. And I was like, diversity and inclusion, like that's what this feels like. That's what I'm experiencing. And so when I got back, I kind of thought about it some more, integrated it, and started to transition from HR directly into, you know, diversity and inclusion. And I think LSD helped me move into this psychedelic space as well.
How did you kind of pitch that to who you were working for? And I mean, how did you bring kind of psychedelics into the mix? And how did you start moving into, because I know after that, then you went to work for, I believe, Numinous and Mass.
Yeah, yeah. It was really in COVID times, the last 18 months.
Yeah.
I've been using an LSD that's treated with Reiki and sound healing. And in the past 18 months, that compound has helped me, like, given me, I think, the strength and the courage to be like, this is what I'm really passionate about. And like, psychedelics and diversity and inclusion work are not that far apart.
No.
Right?
No,
I think for people like us, we see the synergy so clearly. It was just a matter of articulating it in a way with clarity so that people could understand this, like, these two passions and how they work together. And once I could clearly articulate that for myself and put it on my LinkedIn,
I thought
and it made sense and it resonated because I was able to communicate it.
So let's jump into that really quickly, because that's part of my work as well. How did you get into, because I know when we talked before, you said you were kind of skeptical about the Reiki and the sound treatment on LSD. So who brought that to you and how did you come across that?
Yeah. Some friends had it. It's a substance called Unicorn. And like, hey, do this Unicorn. It's LSD. It's mixed with, you know, some Chinese herbs and supplements, and they do Reiki and sound healing on it. And it's like, sounds lovely. Like, I'm here to give it a shot. You know, like, I wasn't expecting it to be or feel any different, but immediately I knew that it was immediately like, oh, this is like different. It was more crisp. It was more steady.
Higher vibrational, like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is like really different. And I have only been using this form of LSD since then, basically in the last 18 months. I have not used, you know, the normal tabs and gel tabs and things that I used to get.
So, I do a lot of work with psilocybin LSD as well, but, I had always started, cause I had this theory. I was telling my boyfriend, like, you know, if you buy this from random places, especially people that are negative when they're cultivating it, that's going to carry over into the plant medicine. And he was like, no, because he had like a bad experience. And I was like, well, I guarantee you it has something to do with that. So I kind of tested it, and I have the Healy device, and it can show me the chakras and the aura of the plant medicine in front of you. So like, laid it out, and I've got scans of it, and it's like you know, all the chakras are like, you know, 20, 30s, you know, and then, so I did Reiki, and then I sent it, IMF frequencies different. That's what the Healy does. And for about a couple hours, and they immediately just like, you know, they were, and then I did Reiki over it, and, completely different experience, completely different medicine, altogether. Mm-hmm. Angelic, very beautiful experience. Whereas like before it was very negative. Same thing, but you know, I think you can transform that, you know, you can transform even the most negative thing into a positive by intention and things like that. And I think people are understanding that more now. And I think that's awesome that, you know, you're bringing that up to kind of, you know, give credence to that work.
And I still run into people that are skeptical, and they're like, you know, Stephen, you're such a like real world, physical world manifestation kind of person. Like, why, you know, how did you start to open your mind to this? And it was really starting to work with Indigenous folks and Indigenous reciprocity. And it got me thinking about like, if Indigenous folks have been, you know, harvesting, you know, their entheogens through care and through community and, you know, you know, religious practice, they're the ones that have been shepherding this for centuries, many, many, many centuries. Who are we to think that like that, you know, their practice is invalidated by our like Western science, which is so new.
And I think it's so strange that some people don't even know that like psilocybin, especially, like, this has been around for since the beginning of time. People think like, oh, so it's just created in a lab. It's like, what? I mean, yeah. And I think that part of the DI work that you're doing, it might be helpful to speak with the people that these indigenous tribes that have been doing this for so long about, because they figured it out how to do this, you know, and how mm-hmm. to include all their people, because they indigenous tribes don't have schizophrenia. They don't have, I had like suicide rates or anything like that. They don't have any of these types of, they accept everybody. And they've also accepted us going down to Peru, you know, and just completely doing, everybody just flocking down there to do ayahuasca. And, you know, they don't, they're still respectful. So
yeah, I need to explore more of that. Cause like, you know, indigenous folks have so much inequity in their lives, but that's probably just because of like Western inequity, the fact that we took their land and haven't respected their practices and have tried to convert them to Christianity and like sure. all these things if without Western influence.
If you're humble and you're respectful and you want to learn, they're there to teach. I mean, every shaman I've ever met, that is of the Shipibo tribe or anybody, they, as long as you have humility and you have a real desire to learn and listen to what they have mm-hmm. to teach, they are open to teaching it to you. They just don't, they're not going to mess with people. They don't want to waste their time with people who are full of crap, you know? Mm-hmm. And they can see through that right away too. I think that very much would be the first place to start, you know, in doing that. But I think you're doing great work in the space. I like Torin Perez's work in this. And I've been thinking for some time, if all the world leaders would just all take LSD or, you know, or psilocybin or ayahuasca, the world would be fucking much better place.
It's a tempting thing to think about, right? I was actually chatting with Josh Hardman at the Noetic Fund about this, and mm-hmm. we were debating like, okay, would we rather dose the leaders or would we rather dose the water for like the people? Like what would be the one that would create the most change? I can't remember his answer. I think he was the people, or I was more the leaders.
Yeah.
But one thing that I've been thinking about is like, that's the fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. But would it, you know, if we think of a lot of these substances as non-specific amplifiers, what if it actually made some people worse or amplified some of the negative things in them?
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, amplifying some of the negative experiences, things you fear, things that it shows you, especially ayahuasca or what I took, which is changa, showed me some of the things I didn't want to look at. And, you know, that I thought I dealt with in shadow work, but I was like, okay, apparently not, you know, and I still had some fears, and it'll show you that. It'll put it right in your face and go, you got to pay attention to this. You want to be authentic? Okay, here you go.
Yeah.
And so yes, it can cause mental imbalances, but I've never seen that happen with anyone. I've seen them get off balance because they feel like crap after, you know, seeing what they've seen, everything that they've done, but it has changed their life in a profound way. People that were not so great people before they did some of these things, and ayahuasca in particular, you know, that's one of the ones that's like a game changer for people because.
Yeah. My first ayahuasca journey will be next month in Costa Rica.
Oh, mine too. So I've done changa and I've done DMT, but which changa has the MAOI plus the kasha root or whatever. So mm-hmm. it's smokable versus, So, and that was, I mean, it was the scariest journey followed by the most profound experience of my life. You know, and I thought, I mean, psilocybin is really kind of my medicine. I do ceremony with it and I understand it. And same with LSD, I understand it as well. And I work with it a lot for healing purposes. But so I thought I understood. And it was like, buckle up because,
yeah. Yeah, I'm really excited. I think that they're particularly doing DEI work. You know, I was quoted by Newark Magazine as being a disillusioned consultant. And the fact checker was like, disillusioned. I'm like, yeah, I'm disillusioned with the diversity industry sometimes because sometimes I feel like it's feeding into the tribalism more.
Yeah.
And it's actually making us more polarized. Like look at the status of the world today. You know, are we closer together? No, it feels like we're farther apart. And I sometimes wonder.
within certain cultures, I believe, like if you're in the right crew, like, you know, my healing friends, like we are all very united and very strong together. But yeah, when you go into the corporate world, it's the dog eat dog world. And it's just not a nice place to be. And I admire you for doing the work that you're doing in that arena because, you know, I'll be honest, I couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. You know? So,
yeah. And there's so much like pain and hurt out there. And sometimes I wonder if DEI folks aren't doing their own deep shadow work and like, you know, healing their inner child and their inner trauma, we have the potential to create more. And I'm like, oh, that's what I knew. I'm like, I've been waiting for, you know, the sign or the calling to do ayahuasca. I'm like, it's time. If I want to do this work, it's time to confront the things that I have been maybe scared to in the past.
And there is, you know, there is that we all have that element of fear, but, you know, the unknown, right? But I believe that ayahuasca is not so much a psychedelic. I believe it is a portal to commune with the divine because, and you'll understand this when you do it, it is beyond anything that it takes you out of your body physically, where you are just thrust into something else and there are sentience and there are things that when you come back matches up here and things that you bring back that it just, you know what I mean? And it's very strange because everybody has different experiences, but they all have this shared oneness and feeling of, you know, there is something greater than me. There is, you know, that thing is inside of me. And it just, there are so many things that are shared. That wouldn't be the case if it didn't, you know, it wouldn't be the case. People wouldn't all be coming back with similar constructs, I guess.
So one thing I'm a little bit, I guess, I'm scared about, nervous about, or just curious about is a lot of my own journey in DEI work has been exploring and accepting my difference. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, hey, I'm different than straight people. I'm different than a lot of these people. And I spent a lot of my life seeking validation from others. And now I'm kind of breaking free from that. I want like a oneness experience, but I'm curious if that's going to like, you know, counteract some of the work that I've been doing to accept my difference. What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? I completely relate to you because in that way I was, you know, I was teased as a child because I was speaking of things like I was in fourth grade and I asked a group of girls, like, do you ever wonder how we got here? And they're like, what is this girl talking about? They're, you know, they're like talking about curling their hair and stuff like that. And I was just like a very deep thinker. And but the teacher called my parents and were like, we don't know. Is she okay? Or whatever. She just talks that way. Like, that's just her, you know, kind of thing. And so I've always been like that. And not a lot of people understand me in that route. But I've always felt like, man, you know, I'm different, you know. Mm. But now I'm starting to, and I say now, it's been the last 5 years, I'm learning to just love just who I am, differences. I'm like a lot of people in a lot of ways. I've just, you know, grown beyond some of the things that other people still need to work with, you know, work on. And I think you'll get there too. Like you'll get that sense of, because when you see somebody who you know is a good person, like in their heart, you resonate with them and you feel that pull. And then you can also see when there's, you know, not so nice person. And I think that needs to kind of, with psychedelics, I think that gap will be bridged where that person will be able to come out and flourish more too. And it won't be so much about who's different or who's alike. It'll just be about we are all who we are.
Yeah. You know? I've definitely been able to accept myself in a way where I'm just so comfortable with myself.
Yeah.
You know, like,
absolutely.
I used to kind of like push back on a lot of things or push back on people. And now I'm just kind of like, I'm just so comfortable with myself now. And
I did the same thing. I used to always think I had to argue with people about like, oh, I have to speak my truth about this. I have to stand up for, you know, what I believe in. And now it's just like, I'm not going to argue with people who, you know, if they don't understand, if they're open to it, great. Like I'll explain, you know, what I have to share, but if not, no big deal, you know, but I never impress anything upon anyone and I respect them for their beliefs too. 100%, you know, that's their right. And that's their right as humans, free will, but we've gotten away from this community tribal sort of sense where, and I know what you're saying, like, yes, that's dangerous to have that singularity type thinking, that hive mind, but we do need to work together. Whereas, you know, indigenous cultures, they live in communities and they all have jobs together and they work on things and nobody has, it's not really work, if you will. And I tell my boyfriend all the time, I'm like, if you love your job, you don't work a day in your life. And I'm always working because I love, and it's not work. I love my job. I love what I do. And I know you probably feel the same way. So I think that that's what it's going to take, is us to come back to a more community-based society where we are integrating with the people around us and not like, you know, here in California, it's like, you don't know your neighbors. They walk right past you. And I'm always like, hi. And they're like, what's she looking at? You know, like, and so, you know, it's just like, I laugh. I mean, but, you know, hopefully some of the work that you're doing in this field will change some of that.
Yeah. It's a lot of exploring what this intersection looks like right now, because it's manifested in so many different things. There's like a corporate side that I work on, helping mm-hmm. employees think about like, what does diversity and inclusion mean to them? Mm-hmm. How is it important to the mission? How do we bring that to life? There's a for-profit side to it too. How do we make sure that some of these treatments that are out there, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, for example, is inclusive and accessible? Mm-hmm.
But it's cost prohibitive too.
So expensive. I know.
Yeah.
And you know, there are different organizations doing different kinds of work. But whether you're for-profit, nonprofit, whether you're research or actually have treatments available, like diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, these are all principles and tenets that need to be thought of. Yeah. Otherwise they just don't get built in, because the world around us is not really a place that fosters those things right now, with capitalism as a driving force.
Absolutely. You know, I've always thought, like, taking a group out, because I used to be in sales, and you know, so I was just take my you know, my teams to do ropes courses. But I'm like, geez, if we could do psychedelics together, like, imagine what a bond that would be. And I mean, I'm just kind of wondering if these are thoughts that you've had kind of in the workplace. And how do you hope to get around that with, you know, the laws right now?
I know as someone kind of doing this in Amsterdam, kind of like doing mushroom truffle, like, leadership retreats. And that's something that I would love to bring to the US,
yeah,
particularly Silicon Valley. I think it is happening, you know, underground. I think some people are, you know, tripping with their friends and executive kind of like leaders, but I would love to do it in a way where executives, people with power and influence, actually examine their leadership style and examine like the impact they want to have in the world. Because whether we like it or not, these are people, you know, the power brokers that hire a bunch of people that make product design choices that impact millions and millions of people. If we can get them to think a little bit differently, more inclusively, maybe they'll stop caring about, you know, that quarterly earnings call. And maybe it'll think about, how do I take care of my employees in a way that they can take care of their families and community? Like, that shift, I think, would just make such a big impact in the world.
I think so too. I mean, and where do you think we're headed with decriminalization? I know in Detroit, that finally passed. And I mean, I'm in California, I'm like knocking on wood, but I don't think our governor's going to let that happen anytime soon, but, you know, hopefully. So where do you think we're headed with that?
I think we're heading in the right direction.
Sure.
I think we're making a lot of missteps along the way.
You know, kind of bumbling around. Happen like it did with cannabis. That's just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's tough. I think sometimes the way to do it is the like medicalization route, mm-hmm. which is like not the way I'd want to do it. But if that is what it gets in our current system, the FDA and the safety and the feasibility things done, I feel like that's where we're actually having a lot of success, mm-hmm. is like taking this highly controlled clinical environment, which is like so not an indigenous practice.
Yeah.
But if that's what we're doing, and that's how we're curing veterans, mm-hmm. and this country loves veterans as they should, mm-hmm. if that is the path, I'm a water sign. So I'm like, what is the path of least resistance? Like, mm-hmm. I can just work around that rock and like, let's just get the job done.
Do you think that's going to take away from the spiritual component of psychedelics?
Yes, but that's why we're here. We can help bridge these two worlds, right? There's an indigenous word called Esquipmunk, which is two-eyed seeing, one eye through indigenous wisdom, one eye through like Western science. Mm-hmm.
So
Mi'kmaq, and I've been thinking about like, even an indigenous person recognizes, hey, there's some science that's helpful for us. Like, we're not going to say no to that. And I think Western science should be looking at indigenous practice and be like, they've been doing things right in managing forest fires long before we got here. So like, maybe we should listen to them. And if we can get this principle right, then maybe we can, you know, do right by everyone.
And I think a lot of people misunderstand spiritual and religious. And I think that's the big, you know, education that you're going to have to kind of get around with people is like, spiritual doesn't mean religious. You can be of any religion, you know, whatever. This is just bringing in these aspects of oneness within, you know, divinity, whatever that comes from or whatever that means to you. Even if you have no, you're completely atheist, that's fine. If you take a substance like this, you're probably going to change your mind. But if not, you at least will feel some sort of collective consciousness energy that will make you understand and have more empathy and more sympathy for people.
I'm excited to explore that for myself, particularly kind of through the end of the year where I have more time. Someone on a podcast asked me, like, what does spirituality mean to you? They're asking me. And I actually had trouble responding to that. Like, I hadn't thought enough about that myself. How do you figure out what spirituality means to you? What can we ask people or prompt people with to get them to explore that?
Spirituality to me is anything that brings me closer to being the best version of myself that I can be, that's authentic, that is honest, and that is helping other people, not just looking out for myself. Obviously, I need to look out for myself first because I can't help anybody else if I don't do that. But it's just whatever's going to help me be most authentic. That's spirituality to me.
I love that definition. I can work with that.
Yeah. Right? And that's that's inclusive of everything, you know, as well. And that some people with that definition, it's kind of like, okay, I don't really have to buy into or subscribe to this or this or this. And I mean, a lot of times when people come see me as clients, they're like, well, I really don't know if I believe in this stuff, but I'm kind of at my wit's end. And I'm like, you don't need to believe in anything. You know, you just need to have an open mind.
Yeah.
As long as you have an open mind, you know, the medicine, the teaching, all of that will show you what you need to see. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had bad experiences as well on psilocybin psilocybin is one of those medicines that there's always a lesson. It always shows you something that you need to pay attention to, mm-hmm. not always what you want to see, but something mm-hmm. you need to pay attention to. And one night, this was very, very scary for me. Somebody said something about autism and I saw my daughter like kind of tick her eye a little bit. And I was like, what's going on? And then she got a headache. And then my mind started going, oh my goodness. Like, you know, something's happening. And then she said, Mom, I have a really bad headache. And then my guides came in and were like, you are going to manifest that happening. Do you understand how powerful your thoughts are? Stop. And I had to go, whoop, you know what I mean? And this was like, you know, hours after I had taken this. This was way, way, way later. But still, your thought, this is what the medicine was telling me. This is very powerful. You need to be careful of your thoughts.
Wow.
So, you know, it's not to be taken lightly either.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely there. It requires education. It requires responsibility. But the people that are facilitating ceremonies like shamans and these indigenous people. And then there's also some of us here who, when we get the green light, we will be able to do things like this, hopefully for others. You know, me doing it for myself and for, you know, the loved ones that I have around me has been invaluable. Like, I know my father and I took psilocybin together. He's never even smoked marijuana. It was the closest. It's changed our relationship forever. We are so close now. And it's like, we used to just fight, you know, when I was younger, it's like oil and water. And it was just, man, we could not get along to save our lives. And now it's just like, we're always on the phone and so excited. It just, it does that. It brings you closer to the people that you love and to the people that you don't love. Like, you understand them better, you know?
Yeah. I always, in some of my DEI trainings, kind of as a weird badge of pride, talk about my kind of conservative Trump voting friends that are some of my best friends that I've made. I mean, they were my friends, you know, before COVID, but in COVID, I've just been getting really closer with them and understanding them. And they're among my best friends and people that I inherently disagree with because we do psychedelics together.
Yeah. And you know what, that I've had that same experience too with, you know, because I'm kind of in the middle. I don't like politics. Mm-hmm. I stay out of it. I don't like any of the politicians that are the choices. And I'm like, everybody's like, well, you don't get, you know, you don't get the right to say anything about it. I'm like, I don't want to say anything about it. I think it's inherently flawed. But the system, same thing. I can converse with my brother who, you know, who's very like, and then my dad, who's a Trump supporter, he's Biden, you know, and I can just kind of sit in the middle and be like, oh, it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah. I like ease into it now. And I'm always like, I'm just curious now about how did that come for you, you know? And it can be kind of uncomfortable for, I think, people to chat with me, because even though I'm being curious, they often have to examine. Like, mm-hmm. I was at a dinner party once and someone was like, hey, you know, I know you do the diversity work, and should I be using the word Black or should I be using the word African-American? Like, how do I like describe, like, you know, like this friend of mine? And I was like, oh, Black is often better because someone, you know, maybe they're not African-American, maybe they're Caribbean, or, you know, Black is just more of a general term. And you're like, oh, I thought Black was offensive. And I was like, oh, why do you think that, or where did that come from? And they just like, they had to like,
I said something wrong, oh no,
like, why do I think Black is offensive? And they had to like get through that. They were a little bit,
and honestly, it's programming. This is all stuff that we've been programmed by, unfortunately, like our families. They don't even realize that they're doing it. And, you know, then society and the media, school, like
legal system,
they've programmed us to not work together and to think that we are excluded, like that, you know, we're not one.
Yeah.
And I've said so many times, if we could just put all of that stuff aside and just, you know, have like a gathering together, and we would realize like our colors don't define us, let our differences unite us. You know, that oneness, it doesn't need to be. I mean, yes, there are horrible, horrific things that we have done to Indigenous people, to, you know, to Blacks, to, you know, pretty much every group that has, I mean, it's awful. But in that understanding of that pain, the healing is changing the behavior for me, you know?
Yeah. It's tough. I want to like validate people's pain and emotion and recognize, yes, there have been generations of trauma before you that you've inherited, and that fucking sucks.
Ancestral stuff is rough. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, there's that some of the ways that we are healing people now are so ineffective, like a diversity training, like, like a, you know, come into this room, we'll talk, and then we go back to our desks. That's not going to heal people. That's not going to heal the generational trauma that an ayahuasca journey would. I mean, they did a study with Palestinians and Israelis sitting and doing ayahuasca together.
I heard about that. Yeah. Amazing.
That's the kind of generational trauma that we need to heal if we're trying to solve big territorial disputes. You know,
yeah. I mean, and gosh, like, I would love to go into a company and like be like, okay, we're going to do ancestral healing work today, like, and take them through that kind of stuff, because that kind of work I've had it done. I learned from an Aboriginal elder, who, you know, the First Nations people, they have these abilities that are just so beyond what I even have. And I was just blown away by that work, and it healed. Like, so I even saw it in my mother and my father, like it healed all of that within them. And my daughter, you know, who's 5 now, she was 3 at the time I was doing it. We went for a walk later on that day, and she was just like, we understood each other. Like, you know, it just brought us so much closer. So ancestral work is because that can be really, people feel the pain of what's happened to their ancestors. And so even though it may not have happened to them, they feel that very, very deeply. Mm. And then people don't understand, well, you didn't go through this, you know, so why do you feel this? Well, no, this is ancestral, so you do feel it.
Yeah. There was a tough situation that arised. I also sit in an audit, like MDMA therapy training program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And an instance came up where an ancestral meditation was done, and it was in a large group. And one person felt that, like, hey, you know, that ancestral meditation, not enough credit was it was just kind of like thrown in by a white practitioner, and it wasn't perceived well by some people. And it was tough to see, because there was a big debate that kind of like ran away in the Q&A about, like,
you have to have somebody facilitating those things who has understanding of all the cultures involved, like true understanding, and has done, because if you've done real ancestral work and with those lineages, you do have the ability to understand mm-hmm. it and bring forth those things in the healing.
Yeah.
Each of the people there, it's not like they feel inclusive, because that's what I'm saying, if it's done right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a valid critique then, in your point of view, that like it does need to come from a place of knowing and understanding. It can't be thrown in as a warm-up activity necessarily.
No, it's a very serious thing. And it's also, when you're doing stuff like that in like a corporation, you need to have not just one healer, you need to have a group of them who have different backgrounds to be able to, and those groups converge together to, you know, piggyback kind of how this goes. Yeah. And then they facilitate that. And those are very powerful experiences. I don't even know if that's being done here in the US, but I know some of my friends do that in Canada. Mm. And it's very powerful work. And they've never had anybody say anything and I didn't feel included in that. Yeah. Mm.
That's good to hear. I mean, one of the things that I'm really passionate about is making sure that we have a really diverse set of practitioners, mm-hmm. Therapists and guides and trainers, because people are calling it different things, but the word that I use, culturally attuned care.
Absolutely.
You need to be able to understand and relate and have some affinity and identity to like create a bridge with the, you know, with your patient in a way that helps you like maximize their healing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're a diverse group. The people that often need the most healing are often like, you know, the people that are the most marginalized and minorities. So we need to make sure that we have a really diverse slate of practitioners to be able to facilitate the healing for this group.
You know, another thing that kind of really bothers me is like some of the clinical trials that are being done aren't being inclusive of different races what's that all about?
I mean, I can tell you what the best/saddest example is, you know, John Hopkins is in Baltimore, and mm-hmm. often the studies that come out of there are like 90% white participants. And I'm like, how did you even like, how did that happen? You know?
Yeah.
I spoke with Terrence Ching, who is, I'm probably gonna mess up his title. Postdoc, he worked under Monica Williams. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of that kind of like original work. And he talks about a few things that kind of like get in the way of that. Oftentimes these clinical trials are just trying to get through to the next stage. They're trying to prove something. So they actually don't take a lot of people with psychiatric comorbidities. So they're gonna like pick like the safest candidates.
But that's not a true aspect of.
And it's less generalizable.
Yeah.
The results are less generalizable.
It's going to create skewed results. Yeah. Because also in different races, these medicines act different and they act in different ways.
Exactly.
So that also needs to be taken into account.
I know. You know? And his solution, kind of, we debated about this. The solution that he says is there's too many institutional and systemic blocks. You need to have a group of people that care about this on the clinical team. Yeah. Can't just be one person. It has to be several people that care, because you have to do outreach to these communities. You have to go to these communities to like get them to participate in the studies. You have to walk them through. They need extra care. Like there's so many blocks along the way that you need lots of people that care to actually diversify the trials. And Right now, there's no incentive. I mean, to us, it's obvious. You want generalizable results. But
So again, they're going to make a misstep and then just get psychedelics out there. And it's not going to be, then there's going to be problems because they haven't been inclusive of everybody. And they don't have an actual, actual study data that's going to reflect that.
I know. And that's kind of what worries me about the medicalization route. Is that, you know, the medicalization is now being backed by capitalism and the VC route. So there's money involved and VCs want you to, you know, be quick about it.
Yeah. Give me my money back kind of thing.
Yeah. and plus some. So that kind of incentive structure does not lend itself well to being thoughtful and careful. And often, I hate to say it, but oftentimes diversifying and thinking about inclusion and equity takes a little bit more time, saves you time in the long run, but it does take investment up front. I mean, to communicate to leaders that that's important to consider.
That's amazing. So the work that you're doing, I mean, are a lot of companies reaching out to you and they totally get it and they're on board, or are you finding a lot of kind of pushback in certain areas?
Minimal pushback, but like the pushback is there. It's always there, you know, and a lot of times it's, especially because a lot of folks that I'm working with now have been humbled by plant medicine. So there's less ego in the organizations that I'm working with, but it's questions about like, well, why do we need to delay, you know, that fundraising drive? Or why do we need to like slow down and think about this? They're more curious about it. Mm-hmm. And then we can tell them like why or why Indigenous reciprocity is important. They get it. Yeah. It just takes a little more time.
Well, that's great. I truly, this is tough work that you're doing. I respect very much what you're doing, and I would love to be a part of some aspect of this because I just think it's phenomenal work. And if done the right way, it will change who we are and as a country, as a planet, as, you know, and if we take that first step, other nations are going to follow. And if we have this, you know, we've always been this sort of leader in how we shape things, but in the wrong ways. And if we now have this knowledge to be able to, we've been given the seed. And it's like, well, this happened to me on my journey recently. It was like, I was given the seed by the Changa spirit. And she said, now you understand. Mm. You take care of it, nurture it, and pass it on with honor and respect. And, you know, like, this is a very sacred thing. So to be, before I open my mouth to say anything to people, I need to make sure, am I honoring and respecting this gift that I've been given? Mm. And for me, that, you know, as long as I'm doing that and I'm authentic with myself, that will shine through. Some people won't like it. I mean, yeah, you're going to get the big companies that are like, no, not going to happen. And I mean, cause I've done remote viewing work for some companies, and I won't name any names, but remote viewing, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's basically you can give them a projection of like 5 years, what's going to be happening with the company and things like that. Remote viewing was invented by the US military. So the CIA was doing that since the 50s. So it's been around for a long time. And it's a very methodical approach to psychic work. It's not actually, it's perceive and record. And it's very accurate. It's about 88% accuracy once you've got training in it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, even with that, they wanted to, well, hurry up and get this. We need to know this. And no, that can't be right. And I'm like, no, this is the knowledge. This is what I have. I didn't make it up. This is what's happening, you know, and they would try to get me to change it or something. And it was kind of laughable. So I kind of like moved out of that.
Can we have the results tell us this? And you're like, that's not how it works.
No, it's like you have to fundamentally change if you want this outcome. You're gonna have to fix the things internally in the company that are wrong. And then I'll give them ideas and they'd be like, oh, that's way too expensive to do that, or da da da. So I don't know. But you know, I really think that because psychedelics are still illegal in the US, but the fact that this is happening right now, mm-hmm. I think is going to be the bomb that kind of gets things set off. The fact that you're doing this kind of work, because this is what it takes, is people stepping out of their comfort zone and going, oh, you know what? I don't care if there's a stigma, you know, because a lot of people before, they're like, I don't want to talk about doing this. You know, people stare at me in a weird way. Like, my family knows, everybody, I'm not, you know, I'm authentic with myself and that's it. Mm-hmm. I am who I am. And my family sees that it's changing me in a good way. So they're like, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's fine. Yeah. It did have this first, like, oh, she's taking drugs kind of stigma.
Right. Right.
And then I was like, no. And then after my dad, you know, took psilocybin, then it was like, okay, we understand now. Yeah. So
I fighting with stigma on a cultural level is another like important aspect of the work, because, you know, getting the people that care leading the trials and getting diverse people in these organizations, the stigma presents a challenge. They're like, I can't work at that psychedelic company because the company I might go to next might judge me, or my family might judge me. So reducing that stigma will help level the playing field for all kinds of different people to want to be a part of the ecosystem.
Yeah. And I mean, people are doing this work at like in their 60s now, you know, mm-hmm. and like, I have a client whose mother is in the Santa Daime Church, which they do mm-hmm. Psilocybin ceremonies like 3 times a week. And I mean, she's my mother's age, and she's the most amazing human being I've ever met. And she's doing this hard, hard work. And she's just like, she's a bright soul, like just a beautiful ball of energy. And she's like, I wish I would have started this earlier in my life, you know, but So, I mean, it will come. I know it will come, and I know we're getting there. So what do you feel like the overall, do you feel positive or do you feel neutral? What do you think? Like, do you think that this is gonna,
I'm always positive. Sometimes I have to like pull myself back from being like a toxic positivity place, but I'm always optimistic.
Okay.
You know, and I'm working my website right now. I'm kind of reworking it, thinking about my values. But one of the values I have is like dream bigger. Like,
I love that.
Yeah. There's just, I dream bigger all the time. Like there's a brighter future ahead of us. Like, if we fight for it, if we're working for it, we deserve it.
You know? Do you know something one of my guides told me? They said, if your friends understand your dreams, you're not doing it right. Like, you need, if you're not shocking the crap out of your friends with your dreams, like, then you go back to the drawing board. So yeah, now when I come to them, I'm like, this is what I want to do. They're like, what the fuck? Like, dude, she's crazy. So
we also have to recognize our privilege, right? That we worked in corporate America, that we were able to have to live in a capitalist environment and to be able to follow our passion in a kind of in an unknown, mm-hmm. not a lot of people have that ability yet. So by doing the work that we're doing, hopefully we can create more platforms for people to do this as their meaningful, purposeful, sustaining careers.
And what do you think, I want to ask this real quickly about, because when I lived in Germany and in Ireland, I worked over there for a little bit, and I'm also German, but there's no homeless people over there. They just don't have it. They take care of their people. I mean, unless it's by choice, right? And so I'm wondering if, because I think I really have this theory, if we helped homeless people by, you know, giving them psychedelics and then having integration therapy afterwards, I don't think that they would choose to be, I don't think they would be homeless anymore. I think they would, because that divine inspiration of like, oh, well, I can do this and this and this. You know how that creativity, that whole thing comes to you?
I'll have to think about that. I mean, so much of my like experience when I think about like, you know, people experiencing homelessness is around all of the like systemic inequalities around them. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a valid point in like, these are people that have a lot of hurt and trauma as well. Mm-hmm. And if we can heal that, that is one piece of the systemic puzzle that can help end the homelessness crisis. I think I had not thought about that before. I will need to think about that.
Well, yeah, I like to bring these things up with somebody who understands, especially with what you're doing, because I will be on the beach walking and I see a homeless person and I will go over to him and chat with them. Hey, can I get you something to eat? I don't give them money, but you know, I bring blankets sometimes when it's cold. And I always could kind of show my daughter, they have a story to share. Don't be afraid of these people. These are people too. Mm-hmm. And something happened in their lives that, you know, and so hearing their stories is like amazing. You know, they're not all drunk or, you know, taking, you know, meth or heroin or whatever. That's not really the case. And I think a lot of people think that, but no, they're just, you know, they've been marginalized, and then, you know, something happened with their wives, left them, and then boom.
Yeah. One of the last times I was on Unicorn, this form of LSD, I decided to walk down Mission Street instead of Valencia Street in San Francisco. So these are
I know, totally two different.
Right. Yeah. And normally I would just walk down Valencia Street and pop it and grab a juice and get my vegan muffin. I'm like, nope, I'm going to walk down Mission Street. And, you know, I think one thing that we are trained to do is to look away, like look away when you see poverty. And I was like, look at it, Stephen, like these are the problems you're trying to solve. Don't look away. You know, like what is his story? What is her story? How did this building get this way? Why is this community experiencing this? Like, and psychedelics, just,
you know,
so
what?
Helpful for like getting the creativity to try to solve these problems.
Do you know what it takes to do that, to look at it? It takes a very strong person, because that also brings up stuff in you that you're like, I've done this before where I've looked away and I'm part of this, you know, kind of this thing that's created this mess. And I, you know, it took me a long time to be able to do it too. And once you look at it and you're like, oh gosh, I'm not okay with this. This is not okay. I need to do more as a human being, you know? And I think we're finally getting to a point where, you know, I think the quarantine kind of helped with a lot of things, because people had nowhere to go and they had a lot of time to think and to think about what they wanted to change. And, you know, for me, it was like, woohoo, I meditated every day, all day. You know, I was in hog heaven, honestly, because I work from home anyway. So it didn't really change a lot of things for me in that regard. But I think also the planet reset, like, you know, they were talking about how the fish were jumping again and swimming, like the salmon, after quarantine, like, because it had so much pollution, and then, you know, flowers and trees were sprouting up everywhere and all kinds of new growth. So I think Mother Earth needed that. And I think this has propelled something. Yes, there was a lot of constriction, but with constriction comes what? Expansion. So I think after that, if we all just remember what we just went through and keep that in the back of our minds, and then change it and make it something bigger and more beautiful, so that we don't have to, you know, go through something like that again, and have more respect for the planet that we're on too, not just the people. Because if we don't have this planet, guess what? None of us are going to be here, you know?
Yeah. I hope we don't lose the lessons, right? There have been a lot of lessons in this last 18 months, and I hope we don't lose them as hard as the time.
Anchor them into yourself. Just drop. It's like, I literally tell my clients, drop an anchor into the ground, and anchor. When you feel a thought like that, drop it in, and then you won't forget it, because it anchors it into your soul. And that way for you, you won't lose it. And then I'll tell other people that when you remember something and something profound comes out of your mouth, anchor it in. So that way you don't lose it. And journaling, you know, and stuff like that obviously helps too. But so tell us, what are the next steps for Millennial HR? And what are you guys kind of getting into next? And what can we expect to see from Stephen?
It's still early days, still getting a lay of the land. You know, I think what's interesting is people are really reaching out to me for help. You know, like it's being proactive now, like, hey, we're building this training program. Can we get your help? Can we get you to review this? Like, we know we want to do better at this. Help us understand Indigenous reciprocity. There's so many different people reaching out with different ideas or questions that I think, you know, just, I'm still getting a lay of the land and figuring out how I can help people. It's just me right now. I'll probably do some hiring next year, grow my team a little bit, depending on what people need. I would still say just my experience and what I'm comfortable with is kind of like this more corporate sphere. That's the world I just came from. So it is helping the larger in psychedelics. That means about 100 people.
That's what it takes, Stephen. That's what it takes, you know, in order for that, because they control, you know, they control most of what's going on here. So if you can impact it at that level, certainly that's going to have that trickle down effect. Big time.
And because the industry is, you know, is so nascent in so many ways, this is the time to make impact. Like, I feel really invigorated that, like, if we can just diversify this team or get the team to understand Indigenous reciprocity in this way, early, quote unquote, that's just going to have really downstream impacts, especially for, you know, working with mats. They're the foundation for pretty much every kind of organization that's in this space sits on that.
Yes. So. And they're doing fascinating work. So, I mean, yeah, well, I ask every guest I have on the show this question to kind of sum it up. But what is your, if you had one message for humanity, what would it be?
Ooh, one message for humanity. Oh, man. That's really hard, Kirsten. I don't know. Get okay. Good sleep.
You know what? That is important. Now, much more important than I think a lot of people realize, because that affects everything in your life.
That's what I'm like. I'm like, what is something that has like wisdom that applies to everyone, that isn't like, you know, super tongue in cheek, but isn't super. I'm like, everyone get more sleep if you can.
Well, and you know, it's funny. I had a monk who was talking to me the other day, and he said he sleeps on a bed that he sleeps in a tent with like a little yoga mat, and he sleeps on his, on his gown, and they fold that up into a pillow. Uh-huh. And he said they take away everything of comfort for you so that you prepare to be uncomfortable and to go to sleep. So when you're already getting that, but here in the West, we have TVs in our room. We eat in our bedroom. He's like, no, the bedroom is for sleep. And I took that and I was like, okay. So I changed some things around here. And like, my boyfriend's like, what are you doing? I'm like, TV's out of the room. Like, what's going on? I'm like, no, I got this advice. And it's, I think, I'm like, it's going to change things. So he's not too happy about it, but it's only been a couple of days, but I'm sleeping better already. Okay. So I think that's fascinating. And I think truly that is great advice. Okay. So listen, this has been so amazing to have you on, and I'd love to have you on again, you know, like in a year, because I know we're going to hear a lot about you. You're going to be doing amazing things. So.
Thanks, Kirsten.
Thanks so much.